My name is Willie. Angst and discomfort of my childhood led me to a life of drugs, alcohol, and crime. Today I work to stay sober, know myself well, and connect with a power greater than myself that I have historically struggled to understand.
I'm Cameron. Curveballs that life had thrown me had me seeking relief through substances. Today, I'm learning that sobriety is just the beginning. Self-love is a learned behavior, and that we never stop surrendering.
Listen to the stories of those who have been where you're at.
Our desire is that you'll hear something that will give you hope and help you to see that on the other side of pain is joy.
And on the other side of hell is peace.
What's up, world? I'm Willie.
And I'm Cameron.
Welcome to the Other Side of Hell podcast.
Welcome, welcome, Willie.
Cameron,
how are you? Good to see you. Feel like a news anchor at this desk?
Feel like an old veteran now. You know?
What do you mean like
being back?
Like maybe you only have like one leg?
Yeah.
Missing a limb?
I feel like I only have one leg a lot of the times, but I feel like I could have something to say, you know? So welcome to the podcast.
Welcome, everybody. Yeah.
It's always good to be in here. It's always good to see you. Thanks for showing up.
You finding your groove with all this stuff?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah.
We'll find out. I'm very excited about this episode because we've been sitting on this war story for a very long time. Heidi's been very patient with us. We got Heidi's war story and she's been through a lot. I'm excited to share that. We got a pretty good topic out of it that I can relate with.
Will you share it with us?
Yeah.
What is it?
Overcoming hopelessness.
Ooh, I like that.
And, you know, we'll roll into her story. You'll know why we got that topic. But over the course of the last year, I've hit hopelessness several times throughout my life, but never quite the way I did this last year. So it's been, I count myself fortunate to have been so far in recovery that I had a program to fall back on at this later stage of hopelessness, right?
Yeah, so, let me ask you, like, what was going on?
So, well, I relapsed on pain pills. You know, I didn't mean to relapse, but also I didn't have a prescription, so I started taking pain pills behind everybody's back, and found myself in a pretty desperate situation. You know, and I'm grateful that I had 11 years of sobriety behind me to where I didn't have to fucking burn my life to the ground this time to get sober, which was the first time I ever got sober outside of jail. I've never been able to achieve sobriety outside of jail prior to this.
Outside of somebody like legally keeping you away from the substance of
sobriety
choice.
Always started for me in jail.
Right.
Always. Yeah. And so, but I mean, it was just, it was a dark place, man. Because, at 10 years sober, you would have never convinced me that I would have relapsed.
Right.
Right. You know, but by 11 years, and it's not like, I wasn't far detached from my program. You know, it's not like I wasn't going to meetings. I was going to meetings. I was working, still talking to my sponsor all the time. There wasn't really a cloud on the horizon. The finances were fine. The relationship was fine. Right. I think there was just a missing spiritual component.
Right.
And
yeah.
And it kind of came around and it, you know, this time around, being in active addiction whilst in recovery was a very interesting place because, you know, I felt like I had to maintain the image of sobriety.
Right.
Where years before I didn't need to maintain an image of sobriety while I was in active addiction.
Quite the opposite, probably.
I needed to maintain the image of active addiction while in active addiction, you know, but I had a lot to lose this time. I had a lot. I had gained a lot over the previous 10 years. And so living a double life at a level that was new to me put me in a very desperate state. And getting sober, I ended up doing fentanyl, and getting sober off of fentanyl is a pretty painful fucking situation, man. Physically, it was physically very, very, very painful. And, emotionally, it was just dark. It was really dark and sad and uncomfortable. And there came a point, in getting sober where I was clean, and I had some time behind me. I don't know, a month, 2 months, 3 months, somewhere in there. And I still wasn't happy. It was still high anxiety. And I thought that I was going to fucking be there forever.
Mm.
I thought that was the bed I'd made. I was just going to be there. And it was kind of cool because we went to a Macklemore concert, and Macklemore, you know, he's sober.
Mm-hmm.
He sings some sobriety stuff, and he did some tributes to sobriety. And, I was overcome with hope, and together with my wife, we stood in the crowd and cried because I was no longer in a state of desperation. I was back in a state of hope. And it was nice.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, that's kind of what it takes. Like, it seems like something is consistent in that story and the story from Heidi and the story, like even my own experience over the last little bit, is that when you're in that situation and you do feel like hope, like everything's hopeless and like it's just never going to change. And how is it possibly going to change? Because you've tried. You've tried to change it. You've tried to pull yourself out of that. You've tried to quit. You've tried to stop. And for whatever reason, it just doesn't seem to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then really, like, that's what it takes is something, whether it's a song or an artist in your case. In my case, it was, you know, listening to other people share their experience, strength, and hope. In Heidi's case, it sounds like it was something similar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being able to get hope from somebody who has had a really sketchy past with a lot of things. And really it's like once you get that hope, that spark, that one thing that you can hold on to, and you hear it in other people and you believe it and you know that they had it just as bad as you did.
Yeah.
And now they're out of it, you know. That's really all it takes. And so
yeah.
I don't know, like in thinking about that, like it really cannot be understated, like the importance of kind of sharing our journey.
Right.
You know, like even you just sharing that story just now, like it's important for people to hear that, like, this is where we came from. And now this is where we are. And it was because I heard somebody's story, just like you're hearing my story.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe it will be something useful for somebody.
Yeah.
So I think, it's important to hear that. And it can be a very difficult place to find yourself in. Obviously, nobody ever wants to get to a state of pain where they do become just miserable and desperate. And, you know, just...
Well, remember, we're dealing with ism. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The big book says we're dealing with alcohol, but we're dealing with ism, you know, because when I relapsed, I didn't have a whole bunch of problems going on. Right. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I wasn't in financial distress. I wasn't in relationship distress. I wasn't over the top successful. It wasn't there wasn't a cloud on the horizon. I found myself in a situation. And
okay,
go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, like, is that fair? Like, your dad was kind of dying, right?
No, this was before he was dying. Like, we were moving him back from the country,
right?
We're moving him into town,
right?
And like, my dad became sick a few months later. After my dad got sick, and after he died, is when I really,
like, when the wheels came off.
Is when the wheels came off.
Yeah.
But the relapse happened long before that, you
right.
know. And it happened with one single pill.
Right, right.
You know, and I stole the pill,
right?
Which was strike one.
Right.
It wasn't prescribed. Strike two. I didn't tell anybody. Strike mm-hmm. three. And the experiment went so well that I decided all I needed to do was manage well. And at that point, the disease of alcoholism took over.
Yeah.
I no longer had sufficient power against the first one. I'd lost the battle against the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point forward, the obsession, the illusion that I could manage well took over. Right.
Yeah.
All I have to do is manage at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I managed all right. I managed to almost fucking die.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Is what I managed to do.
Yeah. I just think it's important to, like, when we talk about this, I think it's important to be honest and open about, like, if I found myself in this situation where I've relapsed, in my case, I turn to food, right? And for me to say that there was no cloud on the horizon technically is true, but what kind of program was I working, right? Was I working a good program? And by that, I mean, like, did I apply these principles in all my affairs?
Right.
Right. And if I'm being honest with myself, the answer is absolutely not. Like, I wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
And if I think about that fact, it's like, well, yeah. So what happens when I don't practice these principles in all my affairs? And by that, I mean, you know, the principles that were taught in a 12-step program. And what happens is the irritable, discontent, and uncomfortable nature of my disease start to set in. And yeah. I start looking for things to relieve me of that. In my case, you know, I turn to food. And it isn't long before that becomes its own thing.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that, yes, like while things in my life were great, like there wasn't anything that I was really longing for. Right. I have to at least be honest about the fact that, you know, like there were certainly things I could have been doing more of and certainly things I could have been doing less of that, I'm sure contributed to, you know, ultimately, the decision that I made to turn to food.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And like what? What do you mean? There's some things you could have been doing more of, because here's the truth of it is these maintenance things,
mm-hmm.
they're not always fun.
Well,
it's
right.
Not like you're running around going, oh, I need to find somebody to help. And that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Especially after you've been, you know, helped people out and it didn't work out, you know, you put fucking unreal expectations on other people and don't even realize that you're doing that. Like that, I think that's something that happens to me is like, I don't want to sponsor somebody because it's a big pain in the fucking ass for me because they don't do what they're going to say and blah, blah, blah. And I put these expectations rather than just doing it anyway, which is therapeutic and my benefit, right? I mm-hmm. go to a meeting and I don't share because I don't feel like I have anything worth talking about and not realizing that it's therapeutic for me to do that.
Right.
You know, I don't put pen to paper because I don't see what the use of it's going to be. I've already arrived, right? Mm-hmm. All these fucking illusions that the maintenance isn't where it's at, right? And that's, the maintenance is fucking where it's at. Like, we know that now.
Right. Well, what I have found, like in my own experience anyways, is that what I do in those instances where, you know, like I'm quote unquote working a program is I'm just checking boxes. You know, did I call my sponsor? Yes. Check the box. Did I meet with my sponsor? Yes. Check the box. Did I go to a meeting? Yes. Check the box. Now go back over those things. Like, were you honest when you talked to your sponsor? No. Were you honest when you talked to your sponsee? No. Did you share and participate in your program when you went to the meeting? No. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
What I find is like, I'm going through the motions, but I'm not participating.
Yeah.
And so like, it's so important. And that's the thing is like, you're absolutely right. Like this stuff, I don't want to say it gets mundane, but it gets mundane. You know, after a while, like it gets like, oh, I got to go to another meeting or whatever the case is. But I think that's just a way for the disease to sneak back in, man.
Yeah, for sure.
It cunning, baffling, and powerful nature is always going to tell us that what we're doing is like what we like not what we should be doing, right? Like that's how I feel, is it feels like when I'm in that place, like basically I don't feel like I should be doing what I, or like I'm currently doing what I should be doing.
Yeah.
Or it feels like I should be doing something else other than what I am doing right in that moment. Like that's how I feel when I'm in that place.
Yeah. Yeah. I got away from one crucial question that I used to ask myself in early sobriety. And that was, Willie, do you want to get better?
Mm.
Right. Because when the pain has subsided, I no longer think that I'm, you know, it's, I'm no longer wanting to get better. I started to think that I am.
Yeah.
I'm better. Right. And so early on, you know, when it came to sharing at a meeting, Willie, do you want to get better? Yes, I want to get better. Well, what are you willing to do to get better? Right. Talk to your sponsor. Willie, do you want to get better? Yes, I want to get better. Then how fucking honest are you being with your sponsor? Right. And I stopped asking that question. And fortunately for me, that question came back alive in me after a relapse. Do you want to get better? What are you willing to do to get better? Right. And going back through after, you know, coming back around, one of the questions that came up was, you know, are you willing to take a look at the higher power aspect that was missing from your program before? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And are you, do you want to get better? And what are you willing to do to get better in that area? Right. And so, yes, I want to get better. So what I'm willing to do is, start looking at the world through a spiritual lens instead of a logical lens.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because logically still, like the evidence for God is pretty fucking thin. It's all anecdotal.
Sure.
Right. All of it, but it seems to be working. Right. Because the last time I used, I had come home and I just ordered a pretty substantial amount of pills. And I still had some from an order before, but I came home and I took one and I started going into a panic attack because I knew it was fentanyl.
Yeah.
Right. And I knew that the possibility of my family finding me dead was very likely, right? Because so many people are dying on this shit.
Yeah.
And here I am with all this to lose, and I took it anyway. And so I tried to throw up. I was like still trying to control my life, right? So I start fucking drinking water and trying to throw up, and I start walking around my neighborhood, and somebody called the cops on me. And they, you know, they saw me walking around fucking puking in the street, and the cops came, and there was a level of concern from them, right? They'd asked me some questions, and somebody said I tried to walk into somebody's house, and you know, this is my neighborhood. Like I've been right there for like 6-7 years.
Yeah. Right?
And so like, the cop was like, well, you know, are you on anything? And I told him, no, I'm not, you know, I blamed it on, you know, I'm going through some emotional stuff because my dad died. And I finally got honest with Avery and told her, you know, I've been using, and it was disbelief from everybody that I told.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, like I can't, to explain the amount of fear that was running through me was crippling because I don't want to die.
Mm.
Right. But I don't want to get clean and I don't want to use, and it's a state of, being paralyzed. I was fucking paralyzed with fear. And I prayed.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
What else am I going to fucking do? I need some hope
mm-hmm.
that I can come through this. And I don't know. Like, I don't want to go back to that place, but I don't want to forget that I was there either.
Yeah.
Right? Overcoming hopelessness has been a massive process. And I think, you know, one of the parts of that throughout this whole process over the last year was coming to terms that that may be how I feel for the rest of my life.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, Like I can't use,
mm-hmm.
and I can't die.
Right.
And I'm not happy. So maybe I am going to feel hopeless for the rest of my life. Right. But I'm here to tell you, if you do the work, which is something that I did, and I asked that question over and over and over again, do you want to get better? And if you want to get better, what are you willing to do? That will put the answers in front of you will come. But so will the necessary work that comes along with the answer. None of it's given.
Right.
None of it's given.
Yeah. Well, you touched on a very basic but crucial point in that story is that what are you willing to do, right? Because I think that that's ultimately like what it comes down to is there's so many people and, you know, I have been there also where, you know, I'm miserable living the way that I am and I don't know how to stop, but it's been explained to me what it is I need to do in order to stop and to get better. And I'm just not willing to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And because I think I have a better idea, right? I
think hope for an easier, softer
way.
Yeah,
yeah. We want something easy, you know. We don't want to have to do the hard thing. And for me, in my experience, by now I've kind of learned that it's the hard thing. Like the hard thing is the thing that works.
Yeah.
Right. And so. Whatever, like whatever it takes, like I've got to get my ass kicked however long enough or however hard enough before I'm willing to do whatever it takes. And I'll do anything that's suggested of me. I think that it's been quite the journey to get to a point where I'm willing to just follow instruction from somebody who's been there.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? Like, I don't know how to do it. It's very clear that I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to keep living the way that I'm living. And I don't know how to stop. And so I need help from somebody who's been there before. I need them to tell me what they did.
Yeah.
And I need them to suggest, you know, certain things to me. And then I need to take those suggestions. And for me, it really has been like, a very, very small step, one step at a time, you know, like the very, very first thing I did when I was hopeless. And for me, like it's been this journey with food.
And your hopelessness isn't that old.
Right.
Like, to be clear, like Cameron's talking like 2-3 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, well, yeah. I mean, but it's been a journey, you know, it's been 6 months ago when, you know, yeah. I kind of started dipping my toes in a certain direction. And just for everybody who knows, like, I'll get right to the point. Like I'm in a new 12-step program for food. You know, today's been a good day.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's like the very first thing I had to do was like, you know what? Like, I'm just going to do this one thing. Like, I'm not going to like. I get that this is what they do in the program, like they no flour, no sugar, et cetera, et cetera. Like I get that this is the program, but all I'm going to do right now is do this one thing. I'm going to go to a meeting. I'm just going to go to a meeting.
Yeah. Right?
And I had to like just keep it very, very simple and very, very small at first. Like I'm just going to test this out. I'm just going to do this one thing. And the very first thing I did outside of going to a meeting was I started listening to this podcast. I'm just going to listen to one. I'm just going to listen to one episode. And it was so inspiring and so hopeful that I literally like just binged, you know, because I'm an addict.
Yeah.
I just listened to like all of them. And it was like, okay, these people don't sound miserable, you know, because that's what I've told myself is like, what am I going to do if I don't have it? I'm going to be miserable.
Mm.
You know, I'm not going to be happy. And these people feel like they've gained so much more than they've lost, you know, and I want that because I don't have that, you know, they seem so spiritual, so serene and so calm and so, you know, peaceful about it all.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what I'm looking for, man. Like, I just can't seem to figure out how to eat like a normal individual and, you know, and not feel guilt and shame constantly and just hate myself moment after moment for the way that I'm treating my body. And these people have all felt that way, and now they don't. And to hear that, you know, story after story after story after story was really like, okay, like, I mean, there's something here, you know? And then it was like, I'll do the next one thing. I'll start asking about a sponsor, you know? And then I start asking about a sponsor. Like, how does that work? What do I do? Like, who do I, does it have to be a dude? Does it have to be somebody local? Does it have to be, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just really like, you know, ask all the questions. And then for me, I mean, and these are all like months apart, you know what I mean? And then for me, it was like, okay, why don't I just call the guy? Just call the guy. Like, I'm not going to commit. Like, I'm not going to say that this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to call this dude. You know what I mean? And then call the dude. And then, you know, like it just kind of happened from there, you know, like you get into it. I got into it. And all of a sudden I'm starting to feel like, okay, like this seems to make sense. Like, I'm just going to do this one thing at a time, one day at a time, and we'll see how it goes, you know? And that's what I've been doing. But like, it started with just one thing. You know what I mean? Like, I just got to convince myself to do one thing, because I'm so good at looking at the entire picture and just thinking like, that's way too much. Like, how could I possibly do that? Like, and why would I do that? And how would I do that? And now I'm just able to like, just do the one thing, dude.
Yeah.
You know? And really, like, I don't think I would have that had I not already been through a 12-step program.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And experience shows, you know, a lot of it too is like what we did wrong throughout, you know, through some of this stuff, because there was a lot of stuff that I did do right, but there were some things that I did wrong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And one of them for me is like, I've always put this version of myself somewhere in the future, right? Like eventually I'm going to be the man,
sure,
that, you know, I can respect. Right. And this is something that I work on legitimately now as we are. Right. And it took me some pain to realize this, that there's this version of myself that I'm always trying to get to, right? Where all the things are matched up. Like, I have the right body, I have the right finances, I have the right spirituality, I have the right eating patterns, I have the right exercise, I have the right skill set, I own the right amount of stuff. Like, and I call this the highest version of myself, right? Like, it's this imaginary person. And what I realized throughout this whole process is that the highest version of myself is the man that I am in the decisions that I make on a moment to moment basis, right? It's not a certain body weight anymore, right? Because I've never been able to achieve that. It's a certain behavior in a situation where I choose one path or the other.
Oh, I like that.
And I sit there and I ask myself, what would that guy do?
Right.
If I was that guy now, what decision would that person make? And that person would make this decision right now with this food or this phone call or this, you know, situation. And that seems to be working for me. Right. Because I've recognized that I'm never going to get to that person. I'm that person now. And it's in this decision that I need to make. Right. Here's a situation with my children. Like, you know, my son's behaving a certain way. If I was the type of father that I wanted him to have, how would that father handle this situation? Would he yell and scream and demoralize this boy? Or would he dig into himself and find some empathy and try to remember where he was at 10 years old, discovering the world, right? And that's the person that I become because of the program that I've created myself, you know? And it all goes back to, Willie, do you want to get better or don't you?
Yeah.
And if you want to get better, what are you willing to do? Are you willing to be the highest version of yourself in this situation? So that you can, you know, get better,
right?
Because we build those habits, right? And it's unfortunate that building negative habits are so much easier. Like they say, 21 days to build a habit. Like, I think I can build a habit of eating Twinkies in like fucking 21 seconds.
Not right.
But breaking the habit of eating donuts maybe is 21 days, right?
Yeah.
But it's these little things, you know, and I think writing this stuff down has helped me. You know, I've written down these goals of the type of person that I want to be, and that helps me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've written the affirmations out. I put some alarms on my phone that go off 4 times a day to remind me to drink water and say my affirmations, right?
Like, mm-hmm.
Because this is who I want to be. I want to be the father that my children deserve. I want to be the husband that my wife deserves to have, you know?
Right.
And the cool thing is that I get to be that person,
mm-hmm.
right? And I get to be that person all day, every day. And it's been beneficial,
right?
Like I've seen it in every relationship that I have,
mm-hmm.
since I decided to start getting better. That better is infectious to the people around us. Have you noticed that? Like, have you noticed that since you jumped on board with this new program and you started working it, are other people's lives in your life getting better as well?
Like,
they seem to be happier, more fulfilled, more present, more.
Well, see, at this stage of the game, I think that it's like this in like almost any 12-step program that you're in. Like, I've seen some benefits, but I haven't seen as many benefits for those people around me. In fact, right now it seems like an adjustment for a lot of those people, and specifically in my situation, in my world, like my wife's having a hard time, like kind of getting used to it, because what it means is like now I'm involved in an additional 12-step program. So I'm going to more meetings and I'm not home as often, mm-hmm. you know, and that's an adjustment for her and that's a change for her. But she has for sure noticed like the change in obviously like the way I look, but the way I feel about myself, she's supportive of that. But I think it has been like an adjustment for her. She is definitely, I think she's lost a little bit of weight as well. Just because we're eating a lot of the same thing, and she eats like I'm eating, then she's down, or she's for sure going to lose some weight.
Yeah.
But I want to take a moment and just go back to what you were saying, because what I think is important to recognize in this instance is that, you know, we don't always take that time to stop in those situations and ask ourselves, like, okay, like what would the man that I want to be do in this situation, right? Like, I think that we cultivate that time and we cultivate that matter of presence through the program that we've already worked, right?
Sure.
Because I think what happens a lot of times, and especially before program, there was no thought. It was, this is what I want to do, and this is what I'm going to do.
Reaction.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was all emotional, you know? And so I think that it's important to at least acknowledge and recognize that, you know, like we're at this stage of the game now where we at least have the wherewithal to stop and ask ourselves these certain questions in some of these instances, or at least have more frequent moments of clarity, if you will. And that's a blessing of having worked a program. And I think that those moments of clarity, like, are gifts. We've been given these gifts, from a higher power or whatever you might want to call it, because sometimes those moments of clarity come to us in situations where we would normally react, especially at the height of our disease. It's usually that one moment of clarity that gets us to take the necessary action. Like, you'll hear it in Heidi's story. I have it in multiple stories of my own, you know, that finally spurred the necessary action for me to begin a path of recovery.
Yeah.
And now, through, you know, treading down that path, we have more of those moments where we can sort of decide, like, okay, what am I going to do here? Like, I can do what old Cameron would do, or I can maybe try something new.
Yeah.
You know, those are blessings. You know, those are blessings that come as a result of the work that we do.
Yeah, I agree. But
in my situation, I for sure know, I am 100% confident that my family, my loved ones, my relationship will improve with them all. You know, because I will be more present. I already am more present, meaning that the quality of the time that I'm getting with them is much greater. And even though the quantity may dip, I'm so much more useful to them as somebody who's engaged. And like, I'm thinking of a situation where I'm playing with my son on the floor, you know, rather than sitting there watching TV while he's playing on the floor, you know, and just wallowing in my own self-pity and hating on myself, or even isolating in my own, you know, office or my own space or whatever it is.
Yeah. Using your responsibilities as a father to detach from the things that you want to do, knowing very well that you could be engaged on the floor, but you're living in your obsession.
Right. Yeah.
Living painful in, fucking yeah. place to be.
Yeah. It sounds like you've been there.
Yeah. 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 Right. And fortunately, like you were saying, you know, that the program puts you on the floor with your son versus in the office.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Today. Yeah. So I'm grateful to at least, have the wherewithal today to know, you know, what's typically going to work in this situation.
Yeah.
And the willingness isn't always there, but at least I have the answer. You know what I mean? At least I have the solution. Now it's just a matter of getting desperate enough to apply it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to figure out where to go or what to do. And for me, it's like, I've always kind of known, it's just, am I willing to do that yet?
Yeah.
Have I had my ass kicked enough?
Seems like it.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you? Do you feel that way? Like, you always kind of knew what to do? Like, you kind of, maybe with this God thing, you kind of knew that you were going to have to come around to that? Or,
you know, I don't know, man. Like, it's been an interesting experience because a lot of stuff has come back to me. You know, I was sharing with a friend the other day, an experience that I had, when I was really young. You know, it was, you know, I was in my late teens and I had just gotten out of jail, and, you know, I was working for a guy. I was doing a roof, and I was doing this roof by myself. And I think I was doing a roof tear off, and I was there alone, and I had just gotten out of jail. And one of the things that I did when I was young, when I'd go to jail, is I'd get into the Bible, you know, and I'd read the Bible, because that's, you know, what my parents did. And that's what my dad was doing at the time. And that's what I was doing. I'd get into the Bible and I'd get out, and I'd have strong resolutions to not go back out and stuff like that. And I had this experience where I was on this roof by myself, and I had walked up to the peak of this roof. And as I came to the peak of the roof, the whole skyline had lit up with a bright light, and I could feel the presence of God. And it was so overwhelming that I told it, fucking back off. Like, this is too much for me. And, you know, I shared that story with him a couple weeks ago, and it was the first time that I'd shared that story probably ever. And now I'm sharing it maybe for the second time. And I shared that story with him, and I said, you know, I said, I wonder what my life would have been like if I had the courage to step over the top of that roof. If I wouldn't have told that feeling of God's presence to back off. And he said something really cool to me, and he said something that I appreciate. He's like, you know, God knew that you were going to do what you were going to do. And that was him telling you that he was always going to be there. And it kind of felt true, right?
Yeah.
Because there were times throughout my entire life where I would go back to that feeling and wonder that same thing, even though I didn't really share it with anybody. And then fast forward to that time in the lake where I baptized my, or de-baptized myself in the mountains, where I came down off the mountain as an atheist. And I went through a few years of atheism and was able to detach from the religious aspect of God that put me into a place where I walked the world godless and self-reliant, even in recovery, that put me in a place where it was time for me to relapse, and I didn't have sufficient, you know, strength to not relapse on my own, that put me into another state of desperation that made me willing to open up to a new way of life. Right. And that whole process, that whole process, right, was kind of an interesting, and I don't know, it's just, that's what it is. It's a fucking process. Mm-hmm. And identifying with that pain, being willing to do the work to get out of it, put me in a position to be a new person and a new level of life experience. I think, you know, all that stuff, it fucking matters. And so it's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
to say the least. I don't remember what the point of all that was, but.
Well, and it's all to kind of just say, like, it goes however it goes. Yeah. Right? Like, we don't get to decide the path. Like, we just hopefully get to follow it.
I could fight a better version of myself tooth and nail.
Right.
But why?
Yeah.
Why fight to hold on to my disease
mm-hmm.
when there's such an opportunity in front of me, you know? And so, it's grateful. I got a lot to be grateful for.
Yeah. You know, you and me both.
So speaking of things to be grateful for, you know, Heidi's story, there was so much in it that I could identify with, and I'm grateful that we got such a wonderful topic out of it and that we're able to just explore this dialogue and bring some of this stuff out to share with our listeners. And yeah, I want to share her story with you guys now. Yeah.
Now's a good time.
Yeah. Let's do it with that. Further ado, here is Heidi's war story.
Yeah, so my name is Heidi Bechtel. It's spelled H-E-I-D-I. Last name is B-A-C-H-T-E-L. And then now I go.
Okay, we'll probably cut your last name out, but.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Sorry. That's fine.
Okay.
You never know who's going to see this, so.
Yeah,
I'm fine.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. It's all you. Take it away.
Cool. Awesome. So, hi, my name is Heidi. I live in Seattle, Washington, and I'm currently 33 years old. And for a major part of my life, I suffered from opiates and benzo addiction. And my main spiral started when I was 24 years old. But before I get started on that, just kind of my early life, I grew up with pretty financially stable middle-class family. I lived with my mom and my two brothers, and I saw my dad on the weekends. My mom, unfortunately, she was pretty emotionally and physically abusive. So growing up, me and my brothers, we were just terrified of her. It was like a war zone, I would say. Just like you never knew what was going to upset her or set her off. So as a young child, the way that I learned how to deal with that was just to go inward, and I became very quiet. I made myself very small, and that was my way of being safe and not attracting attention from her. Thankfully, though, my dad was really loving, and he was the light in my life as a child. I would see him every other weekend. So it helped. It didn't completely undo the damage from my mom, but just having him in my life, it kind of showed me like what was actually normal and what love was like. And he was the greatest dad. Like, he really was. And we still have a great relationship to this day. Whoever watches my Instagram, like, they'll see like me and my dad together, and, you know, we're giving each other crap, and we have a really good relationship. And I just really love him a lot. Growing up in school, I did really good. I did sports. I wasn't like a bad kid. I had good grades, never got in trouble. But I just had really bad anxiety. And one of the ways that I used to medicate it, was with Xanax. And the first Xanax that I ever got was actually from my mom. And I don't remember how old I was when she first gave it to me. I think I might've been like middle school or something. I don't remember what was quite going on. Like, I wasn't sleeping well or something like that. And she gave me a Xanax, and I remember just really liking it and being like, this feels really good, and I really like this. And being a shy, anxious child, like, that's what I wanted. I was like, I want more of this. And there's actually a few times where I'd gone into my mom's bathroom and I had taken some of the Xanax from her, and You know, looking back, that was pretty dangerous. But being a child, I didn't really know any better. I just wanted that feeling. So when I was 24, my spiral downhill basically started after a breakup. And before that, I would kind of use Xanax on and off. I got some from a doctor from like PTSD, from like the child abuse and things I had been through. And I wasn't quite like medicating with it so much. Like instead of, when I would go to a party, I would maybe like, instead of drinking, I'd take a Xanax because I just liked how it felt better. So when I turned 24, that was when things really went downhill. So I had a breakup, and I remember the guy, he had made some comment about my nose and how it was too big. And I had been bullied for having a big nose my whole life. My mom had told me I had a big nose, that I was ugly, and that I needed to be fixed. And so I had this ingrained idea that there was something wrong with me. So basically what I did is after this breakup, I was like, all right, I'm going to get a nose job, and then I'm going to go to Southeast Asia for a trip because it's something I've always wanted to do. This was just my way of being like, fuck the world, fuck everything. I'm just going to do what I want. I stopped going to school. I quit my job. And I got the surgery, and it did not go as planned. It got pretty fucked up. The doctor, he did way more than I had asked. I had just wanted a very slight thing done. But when I woke up, I had this very tiny Barbie nose. And the difference was pretty shocking for me. So when I looked in the mirror, I didn't recognize my face. And it created this weird disassociation between my sense of self, and my anxiety just got even worse. And I remember telling the doctor that and being like, I'm kind of fucked up in the head right now. Is this normal? And he's like, oh yeah, you'll get used to it. He prescribed me some Valium. Of course, that wasn't what I really needed. I probably need to go to therapy. But my trip to Southeast Asia was in 2 weeks, and I still wanted to go because I had spent the money. This was something I wanted to do. And what I did is I just kind of compartmentalized this trauma. So I was like, all right, I'm kind of fucked up right now. I'm just going to kind of put this away. And hopefully if I just kind of ignore it, it'll get better. So I went to Southeast Asia. I backpacked around for about 5 months. And I went to like Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Cambodia. And I was just slowly like deteriorating mentally. And one of the reasons was because in these countries, you can get drugs really easy. You can buy Xanax, you can buy pain pills. Like when you're walking down the street, people come up to you and they're like, hey, do you want ecstasy? Do you want heroin? Do you want this? So it was really easy to get anything I wanted. So I was kind of living like this kind of hippie backpacker lifestyle of like going out and partying on the beach and like getting high and like doing mushrooms and like swimming in like bioluminescent plankton. And it was like, it was my dream of everything I'd wanted to do, to go travel. But mentally I was just like so fucked up. My anxiety was so bad. I was just using drugs so much. I became dependent on diazepam when I was out there. I remember I kind of tried to like get off of it, and I just had this massive panic attack. And that was when I was like, oh man, I'm kind of fucked. Like I'm basically like hooked on this stuff now. And so basically it was, I'd been out there for about 5 months, and I was starting to run out of money. And I either had enough money to fly home, or I had enough money to fly to Australia and buy a work visa. And I wasn't ready to go home. I kind of wanted to keep this whole thing going. Because I knew if I went home, I would have to face everyone that I knew. And part of my plan with getting the nose job and then running to Southeast Asia was like, oh, I'll have time to heal. And then I'll come back and it'll be like 6 months or a year. And people won't really notice that I did something. But the change was so dramatic. So I was like, I'm fucked. I was like, when I get home, everybody's going to know. And like my swelling was pretty bad. Like my nose for a while, it was really pushed up. like it kind of looked like a pig nose. It was like really bad, and I was just like, dude, I'm so fucked. Like I fucked myself up. And being a girl, like that's a huge deal, you know. You're just like, dude, my fucking face, like I can't believe I did this. And so I decided to go to Australia because I needed money, so I got a work visa. And I was there working. I got a job cleaning pools, and I was staying with some Aussies that I'd met when I was backpacking in Australia. And the job was cool. I was like cleaning pools at like these mansions, and it was pretty chill. But I started to run out of drugs, and I was like, oh shit. And like, I actually went to the doctor, and I tried to get some drugs, and was like, hey, I get Xanax in the States, I need some here. And they were like, no. And I was like, oh shit. I don't know what I'm going to do. So my depression started getting worse, and I started going into withdrawals. And just like the final straw. So I was basically already like circling the drain. I was like just mentally fucked, bad anxiety, withdrawals. And I was coming home, and I was followed by a guy. And unfortunately, I was walking, and I remember getting hit from behind and being dragged, and I was screaming. And unfortunately, I was like sexually assaulted by this guy. And after that, like, I don't really remember a whole lot, but I just basically kind of went into like a state of psychosis. And it just, the trauma was so intense. Like, I was already really like just fucked up, and then that just was like the last straw. And I called my friend Kevin. I was talking to him, and I didn't tell him exactly like what happened yet, but I was like, hey, I was like, I'm suicidal, I think I might kill myself. And he was like, I was talking to him, I just remember him being like, hey, like, hang on a second. I heard like some typing. And then he was like, hey, I bought you a flight home, get to the airport right now, like, please come home, we'll figure this out. And I remember just being like, okay, like, fuck. So the flight home was like 10 hours. And I remember I didn't even think I slept. I was just like in this, I remember I just had these recurring thoughts in my head about like how I wanted to die, and I didn't want to be alive, and how I'd fucked myself up physically. I'd gone on this trip, and like, even like my dad and some people were like, oh, you shouldn't go on this trip, it's dangerous, something bad could happen. And it was kind of like this, like, I told you so type thing. Like, you shouldn't have quit school, you shouldn't have quit your job. And now you're in this situation where you're even more fucked up than you were before. And it just really sucked. So I get home, I'm living with Kevin, and Kevin, at the time, he was struggling with a heroin addiction. So I was living with him. He was still working. And the night that I got home, he had offered me a Percocet, and he was like, hey, like, do you want this? Like, I know you're probably in pain. And I was like, yeah, like, I want it. So I took it. And it was like a moment of just relief. It stopped the constant thoughts in my head. And later on, I didn't find this out till later, but basically what had happened is the trauma had induced obsessive compulsive disorder in my brain. And I had developed what is called pure O. And OCD, it's almost kind of like having Tourette's, but with your thoughts, and you can't control them. And they're very constant, and they're very loud. So anything that happens, like if I watched a scary movie, and if I saw like a bloody movie scene or something, with OCD, OCD can grab onto that, and it will just replay it in your mind over and over and over again. So with me, my OCD was just replaying my trauma over and over and over again, and I didn't know how to make it stop. It was like this record. So it was basically just like pure hell for about a month. And the way that I would get any relief from that was drugs, was Percocet. And I was also like smoking weed. Kevin had offered me heroin, but I was like, no, I was like, I'm just, that was like where I drew the line for some reason. I was like, I'm not doing heroin. I was like, the pills are good enough. So Kevin and I, we were like together every day. Like, we would get high, we would watch movies. Like, we were like each other's support person. Like, he was there for me, I was there for him. He was going through this really bad divorce, and he had tried rehab, but it wasn't, he just wasn't having success with it. So out of desperation, this is maybe 3 months after I got back, he decided to go to a clinic in Costa Rica that did Ibogaine treatment. So he went down there, and he did one round of Ibogaine, and I remember him talking to me and being like, oh, it's really great. I think it's really working. I don't have any desire to use. And then he decided to do a second treatment, and unfortunately he overdosed and he passed away down in Costa Rica. And that was the hardest news ever, because he was my person and he was my best friend. Sorry. And I remember just having all these mixes of emotions. Like, I was so angry. And I also felt abandoned, because we were supposed to do this together. We were supposed to get better together. But I had, like, also this rage. I wanted to go down to that clinic and I wanted to burn it down. And I wanted to kill everybody in it because they took him away from me. So I was getting better, but then Kevin dying just kind of put me back down. And for the next 5 years or so, I used drugs on and off. I was in therapy, but I was just kind of staying constant. Like, I got better enough to where I was able to work and kind of live a normal life, but I was still, like, pretty depressed. Like, I just remember just feeling suicidal, like, all the time, like New Year's or any type of birthday. I remember just being kind of like, fuck this. I don't want to be here. Like, what's the point? Like, life sucks. And I was using Percocet and Xanax, and I was just numbing all of the pain, all the trauma. And there's a few instances where my use had gotten pretty out of control. My addiction was... no one ever really knew. No one was ever like, hey, Heidi, I think you might have a problem or what's going on here. I hit it pretty well. But the only time I got caught, I was on a friend's boat. And like, one of the guys on there had a bottle of Xanax. And while everybody was up above partying, I went down below and I went and stole Xanax. I took it. I'd been drinking, so I blacked out. The next thing I knew, I was on shore in the grass, and I had been kicked off the boat. And the boyfriend that I was with at the time, he was like, you were acting like a goddamn goblin. And I was like, oh shit. And I was so embarrassed and so ashamed, because no one had ever found out. I'd never been caught, nothing. Like, my whole life, that was the first time I'd been caught. And the next time I kind of had a bad experience was my regular dealer. Her pills were prescription, so I had felt safe taking them. But there was one time she ran out, and I was really desperate. So I went and got some pills from someone else, but they looked different. They didn't look like the Percocets I was used to. They were white and oval, and they had some different numbers on them. And I Googled them on, like, drugs.com, and they didn't match anything. And I was like, oh, I think these might be counterfeit or some fake pills. And you know, I felt kind of nervous, but I was like, oh, if I just take a little sliver, just test it out, I'll probably be fine. And I remember I took a little sliver of it, and I decided to, like, go do some errands. So I drove my car to, like, a Brown Bear car wash, and I was, like, vacuuming it. And I just started to feel that, like, intense high. And then, you know, I just remember kind of feeling, like, too high, where you get that, like, metallic taste in your mouth and you start to almost feel pain instead of pleasure. And I was like, damn. I was like, thank God I didn't take that whole pill. You know, if I was in my apartment by myself, I probably would have just OD'd right there. And that was when I took a real good look at myself. And I was like, Heidi, I was like, you're risking your life to get high. You're risking everything. And I just thought about my, I just went really deep. And I thought about my family and if I died, how they would feel. And I thought about my dad. And it just broke my heart, because I knew how much my dad loved me. And if something happened to me, like, just the thought of the pain it would put him through was heartbreaking. And I just couldn't do that to him, even if it meant that I would be in agony being sober. I could not take the risk of overdosing again because I couldn't do that to someone I loved. And I would just do these visualizations every time I had this desire to use about like my face on the news or this girl, you know, like girl ODs or something. And I was like, I don't want that to be my story. Like, I deserve better. Like, I can do better. I know I can. So from then I just decided to just stop completely. And it was going good at first, but then because I had been numbing all of that trauma and all of that anxiety, everything just came out with like a vengeance. And I started having panic attacks every day. And then the intrusive thoughts came back, the ones that I'd been numbing from when I was from that trauma in Australia. And they got so bad. I seriously thought I was going insane. I was like, there's something wrong with me. So I went to a community walk-in clinic and I got an evaluation. They diagnosed me with OCD. I started therapy. I never went to like NA or anything like that. I just kind of worked with a therapist and that helped me get clean. So over the course of a year, I had been sober, but I kind of did the thing a lot of addicts do where I put down the drugs and I pick up the fork and I gained 40 pounds and I felt better being sober, but then my self-esteem was pretty down. I didn't feel good about myself. I still felt kind of unhappy. And there was one morning I decided to Google like motivational videos and I came across a video of Wes Watson. And his words just spoke to me. And I was like, wow, I was like, this guy, there's something about him. And he spoke about pain avoidance and self-mastery and how if you can master self, you can master anything. And I was like, that's what I need. I was like, I had impulse with drugs. I have impulse with food. I was like, I need to learn how to do this. I need to stop numbing. I need to be okay with pain. So I got on his program and his program was really rigorous. It was very intense workouts, very intense tracking your diet. Like his whole point is inflicting adversity. So that way you become comfortable with pain so you can handle it. And then when you're showing up for yourself every day, you gain self-esteem, you gain self-love. And through that process, my confidence blossomed and I became proud of myself for the first time. Like as a child, I never had self-esteem just from my mom. There was just no way I could develop it. And his program really helped me so much. So over the course of a year and a half, I worked with Wes and then I decided to do his business coaching program. So I became a coach and now I've been helping people and it's been so rewarding. And, since doing his program and gaining confidence, I went back to college and I graduated. My dad got to see me walk across the stage and I did it sober. There's no way an anxious girl like me could have done that sober all that time ago. Also just me doing better helped my dad a lot. He didn't really struggle too much with stuff, but I think just him seeing me doing so much better motivated him to stop drinking wine. And he's lost weight. He's lost 30 pounds. He's doing so good. And also I fell in love with an amazing guy. And this guy had liked him for a long time, like 9 years. And there was a point where we had almost started dating in 2016, but I was still drug addicted. And I was like, if I date this guy, I was like, I know I'm going to fuck it up or I'm going to hurt him. And I didn't want to do that. So I, at the time I pushed him away and it was really hard. And it, I just remember just feeling like so much pain because I really liked him and cared about him. But now everything kind of came back full circle and now we're dating and we have the best relationship and I'm just such a much better person now. So that's my story, and I hope that my story can offer some hope to show, like, you can come from below the bottom, like, just mentally fucked, like, you think there's no way coming back, and there was a time when I was thinking about suicide, and I remember thinking like, well, if I kill myself, I'm definitely not going to get better. I'm definitely not going to get out of it. But if I stay alive, if I keep myself alive, then there's, even if there's a 0.1% chance that I can get better and I can make it out of this, then I want to see if I can make it. So I hope if my story, if anything, it can just show to just hold on, just do anything you can just to hold on. And if I can do it, you can do it.
Cool. Perfect. Real quick, like just roll into and say, if you want to give us your social or your platform, just as if you never stop talking, just if you want to follow me or find me, you can connect me at the
And if anybody wants to follow me or find me, if anybody wants to talk or anything, my Instagram handle is Heidi_Bechtel_fit. Should I spell my name?
Yeah.
Okay. So my so if you want to follow me or find me, my Instagram handle is Heidi_Bechtel_fit. That's Heidi_ Bechtel_fit. Even if you have any questions or anything, or if you want some coaching, I'm here to help. This is what I feel like my purpose is to help people who have been through stuff like I have. So yeah, thank you so much for listening.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah. See,
well, that was worth the wait.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate it. I've talked to her a few times via Instagram and told her that, you know, we're working on it. It's coming around. And I even offered to have her redo it. And she thought, no, let's just keep what was there. Keep it organic, you know? And, yeah. So thank you, Heidi. Thanks for sharing that. I know there's a lot of vulnerability in there and you're out there crushing it. Just doing it. So
a lot of really good things in there. I really enjoyed hearing about this trip that she went on, right? Southeast Asia, then Australia, and then, where she ultimately ended up. But I liked hearing about that because you could hear, and she even said it, you know, that she just didn't want to come home and quote unquote face the music.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it's funny the things that we'll do, in order just to not have to deal with the reality of our situation.
Inevitable.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like I really identified with that, even though like I wasn't traveling, but I'm certainly avoiding what it is I have to do, you know?
Yeah, me coming clean on my relapse was long overdue, right? And I understand that delay. That delay, it's very, 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 very scary. And the cool thing is that after we finally face the inevitable, look at all the good that comes from that.
Yeah.
Like her dad's better.
Right.
She found love. She found a program that helps her with the anxiety and the fear and the trauma, getting through all that stuff. She's helping people.
Yeah.
And what a great deal to be able to help the people that we love through our own stories and our own experience, and then share that and identify, you know, where we can go, you know, to our sister or our parent or whoever and be like, you know, I identify with you. Right
now. Yeah.
I'm there.
Yep.
We can get through this together. And that's what I love about these stories. And that's what I love about this podcast is that, that's what it's about, is Heidi sharing her story on a larger platform for people to identify with, to say, ah, that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt. I get that. There is a solution.
There is a way.
Yeah. So
it's definitely not hopeless.
Yeah. The hopelessness goes away. And I'm grateful that I'm not there. You know, that feeling of dissipation of the hopelessness and recognizing that I was smiling and happy.
Mm-hmm.
Such a fucking gift.
Yeah. Just do the one thing, man. Just do the next right thing and it'll probably be okay.
Yeah. I like that. Sent better.
That's right.
So cool.
right, man. Well, here's another one in the bank in the new studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting better.
Yeah. You feel a little bit
loosened up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Gives me some purpose.
Well, should we do it again?
Yeah.
Let's come back. Let's not wait. What? Year and a half?
Yeah. That's right.
Not this time.
Let's see if we can get in here sooner.
Maybe we don't need to, I don't know, completely relapse and.
Yeah. Almost burn our lives to the ground.
Yeah. And put on however much weight.
Yeah.
Before we come back.
Cool. Well,
good idea.
Yeah. We will see you on the other side.
Remember, you are worth the work.